This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Downtown New Bern is a revitalization success story. Within the past few decades, the city center has undergone a dramatic transformation and now boasts a vibrant art scene, a variety of restaurants, and plenty of shopping. As downtown New Bern draws more attention, it's also experiencing some growing pains preserving its small-town charm. The main issue of contention is adequate parking for all of those tourists and locals.
The primary concern with parking is from about 10 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That's the prime time that parking is a problem.
New Bern Mayor Dana Outlaw says parking was an item of discussion during a Board of Aldermen annual retreat back in February, but has since taken on a life of its own with petitions showing up in local business storefronts.
The staff were asked at the retreat to study parking, and they brought back to the city, the Board of Aldermen, their ideas on parking, and part of that was parking meters at our sacred cow of sacred cows, Union Point.
The picturesque 6-acre Union Point Park is located where the Neuse and Trent Rivers meet, offering views of sailboats and yachts coming and going through the Alfred Cunningham Memorial Drawbridge. According to the New Bern Sun-Journal, the item of discussion called for 215 parking spaces and 3 kiosks, allowing parking for $5 a day or $1 an hour. Talk of parking meters has caused a bit of a stir in the downtown area. The owners of Sweet Peas Cafe and Captain Ratty's started petitions, garnering thousands of signatures from locals, people across eastern North Carolina, and around the United States. David Milnes, manager of Beartown Fudge Company, says he opposes the idea of parking meters.
And the downtown's very vibrant area, and I think a lot of people are coming in from all parts of the country, and I just somehow think that the meters would deter and people would go to other areas. So.
On Tuesday morning on Middle Street, John Lloyd was taking in the sights and sounds of downtown. He's on vacation with his wife from Ontario, Canada.
I think it wouldn't be a good idea. Not just because I'm a tourist, because I don't mind paying, because most Ontario places have paid parking lots type of thing. But I think because of the people in this area, they're so friendly and stuff, it might take a bit of the charm away from the main streets.
Parking on Middle and Craven Streets can be hard to come by, especially 8 to 4 Monday through Saturday. Often folks have to park a couple of blocks away and walk to their destination. However, some believe it's not that inconvenient, even when downtown is bustling.
Like on the 4th of July.
Or a mum fest, but I always found one in the end, you know what I mean? You gotta drive around a little bit longer, but yeah, I've never had a problem. I've always found one.
David Height was at the farmer's market with his friend Kristen McCauley, also from New Bern.
Well, I mean, it would make revenue, I'm sure, but I'm sure it probably pisses a lot of
people. It's a waste
off.
Of money, you know, to invest in. And yeah, it might eventually make revenue, but I don't think it's worth the hassle.
City officials are paying attention to the buzz. Alderman Jeffrey Odom believes the proposal presented by staff on how to address the downtown parking issue caused residents to believe that all parking downtown would be metered. In an article published by the Greenbrier Gazette, Odom says he is not in favor of on-street parking meters in the downtown business district or at Union Point Park, but supports a thorough evaluation to find an amendable solution. Mr. Odom declined our request for interview. I was able to speak with Dallas Blackenston, New Bern Alderman for Ward 1, which covers downtown. Blackenston is opposed to on-street parking meters.
This just happened to be one item that kind of got cut loose and basically folks started running with the thought that this was a done deal.
He says the discussion in February was a small part of an ongoing comprehensive downtown parking management plan.
We started 2 years ago to look at trying to address not only parking, but the continued economic revitalization of our downtown with a development finance initiative under the cognizance and work of the North Carolina School of Government in Chapel Hill.
The 2015 study explored the potential development of 4 city properties that included a parking deck near City Hall. Parking meters were proposed as a way to generate revenue for the project.
The concept under their development is for a mixed-use parking deck that would expand our off-street parking capabilities as well as provide an option for expanded retail on Craven Street, as well as more permanent residents downtown or a hotel package that would be a part of this.
Blackenston says aldermen are currently in discussions with Craven County government about the funding and placement of a mixed-use parking deck. He says they're also assessing the parking needs of downtown business owners and their employees as part of the comprehensive plan. Mayor of New Bern, Dana Outlaw, says since spaces are limited, Business owners and their employees should refrain from using on-street parking.
And they have an opportunity to open their arms and their goods and services to New Bernians and out-of-town folks if they're willing to give up the parking space in front of their own business, which many of them are parking in front of their own business. That's crazy.
Outlaw urges folks to seek out free parking areas located throughout the downtown area.
Part of that is the education of the public, both local and tourists coming into the area, with proper wayfinding and proper maximal use of the farmers market, which is a city-owned parcel of property. Possible parking at Union Point, free.
Parking is also available behind the Fireman's Museum and in the lot behind the Harvey Mansion. The city will continue to work out parking issues as they complete the comprehensive downtown parking management plan. While no timeline was offered, public involvement is part of the process. There will be public meetings before the plan, with or without parking meters, is rolled out. I'm Jared Brumba. Eastern North Carolina has one of the highest concentrations of black communities in the state. Bertie, Hertford, Northampton, Edgecombe, and Halifax counties make up the top five highest African-American populations, with Washington and Martin counties rounding out the top 10. African-Americans are also nearly twice as likely to have diabetes than their white counterparts, a disease that is closely linked to obesity, which is also prevalent in the black community. With that in mind, Dr. Damon Swift, a kinesiologist at East Carolina University, and his team of researchers are preparing to conduct a six-month study focusing primarily on African-American patients. Chris Thomas spoke with Dr. Swift about the study and has this.
If you were to make a profile for your ideal participant in this study, sorry, age, weight, but also, how susceptible they are, vulnerable they are to getting diabetes, what would that be?
So with any research study, there are certain criteria that we look for. And what we're really trying to do is identify those individuals that are high risk for future diabetes that are also African American. So we're looking at adults that are 35 to 65 years of age who are currently non-smokers. And not currently diabetic, because we're looking with the study on trying to reduce the severity of risk factors for diabetes. So we're looking for individuals who are not diabetic, not already participating in an exercise program, and some folks who are a little heavier. So we're looking for obese adults, and that means we take sort of your height and your weight, and we're looking for what we call a body mass index greater than 30. And the easiest way to do that is, having an estimate of your height and your weight, and our research staff can easily do that to try to see if you qualify.
Why have there been so few studies on diabetes and its impact on the black community, even though it disproportionately affects the black community?
Okay. One of the reasons that I think there's not been as much research done, and really what we're talking about is from the standpoint of exercise. I'm an exercise physiologist by training, meaning that I'm really interested in how exercise affects disease. And I think one of the reasons is that, number one, it's a health disparity population. It's a much, much harder group in general to do research about. There are certain barriers to research from the participant standpoint. One is that there are certain aversions to healthcare. There are certain aversions to research. And since we look like a healthcare entity, a lot of times you have to have trust from the community in order to do this types of research. And so I think sometimes researchers actually shy away from doing studies in these populations. And that was one of the reasons why we felt so motivated to do a study that compares different types of exercise training and seeing how that actually impacts diabetes risk. It seems to be a very large gap in the literature. And also the risk for type 2 diabetes in the African-American community is almost twofold compared to Caucasians. So it's very, very much needed, and we need to know what's the best way of trying to reduce risk through exercise.
With all that in mind, could you run me through how this study is going to work? It's my understanding this will be 6 months long, and we'll deal with exercise, and you're going to see how exercise impacts people who may be at risk for diabetes in the black community. So with all that in mind, walk me through a bit of the methodology of this proposed study.
If you're a research participant, the first thing that you would have to do is actually call our site. And what we do is we ask you a variety of questions about your health and your exercise habits. We also do ask questions about your time, because some people don't have as much time as they think they do when it comes to, you know, actually, you know, coming and exercising 3 to 4 times a week over here at ECU. We'll also do something to screen how much physical activity you're currently doing, so to try to get an idea of how active you are. And then after that, we do some medical testing. So with any exercise study, you know, there's going to be some medical testing involved that feels a little bit like going to your doctor. But what we try to tell people is that if you can get through the testing, after that, you're exercising. And we the good thing about being in our study is that if you're not happy and we can't get you to exercise for 6 months, we don't get our data. So it's really our incentive to do everything that we can to keep you active. And when I say active, trying to meet the definitions of the physical activity guidelines. So moderate activity is sort of seen as about 150 minutes of moderate physical activity. And when you talk about that brisk walking or the vigorous physical activity, that's seen somewhere more around that 75 minutes per week of exercise.
But when do you hope to get this study started? With that in mind, this is a 6-month study. About how soon do you hope to have the results finalized and published for public consumption?
All right. So we're actively recruiting right now. So if folks that are out there are interested in exercising with us, and we try to recruit people for our staff, they're exercise physiology majors and undergraduate and graduate and doctoral students that are involved in the training. So you'll be under their watchful eye, which a lot of people have found helps with accountability. So if somebody is going to call you and say, hey, you haven't shown up for exercise today, sometimes that helps people get into the door. And we all have busy lives, but sometimes it helps solidify a schedule for exercise that a lot of our participants have found valuable. So that's one really good thing about a really good thing about the structure of the study is that it allows regular exercise. So we're actively recruiting right now, and so we started recruiting in November, and we're going to go for 3 years. Hopefully, if everything goes right, we hope to have a manuscript published from the results of this study somewhere after those 3 years from now. So usually probably about 6 months after the study is completed is when we would have the manuscript. It's a very hopefully all the things that we collect and all the things that we're looking at with exercise intensity and heart disease risk factors, it's a very good sort of reservoir for data that we can use to hopefully figure out how exercise which type of exercise program best benefits people in the African American community. And hopefully if this study is successful, it can lead to other studies in the future to really try to other exercise programs perhaps, or maybe using what we find in this study to figure out another line of inquiry along the in the African American community.
Dr. Damon Swift is assistant professor at East Carolina University's Department of Kinesiology. Dr. Swift, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Transportation across eastern North Carolina's rivers and sounds has been a way of life for hundreds of years. Before the technology existed to build bridges to span those large gaps, ferries were the only way to cross. But as populations along our coast grew during the 1900s, ferries became integral to residents and the tourism industry. This week, Mac McKee speaks to the Associate Museum Curator at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Beaufort, Ben Wunderly, about a free presentation next Wednesday delving into the history of North Carolina's coastal ferries.
When did ferry operations begin in eastern North Carolina, and how did they work? I think we're talking about as far back as the 17th century, are we?
Yeah, that would have been some of the earliest records, and these would have been simple, small vessels to basically get across some of the coastal rivers here in eastern North Carolina. They might have been sailed, something that was maybe even rowed, or sometimes if the water was shallow enough, they just would have pulled across the river.
In those early days, the ferry system, how it ever existed at that point, was a private enterprise operation. How much did it cost, say, back in the colonial times to take a ferry?
Some records indicate that it might have been roughly 30 to 40 cents for a passenger to ride. If you were on horseback, it would have been twice that.
What other things, apart from horses and carriages, did these early ferries carry across apart from people?
They might have carried any type of commerce, whether it was agricultural products or maybe even fish that had been harvested in the local areas.
Looking ahead to the 18th and 19th centuries, North Carolina was still not very heavily populated then. How many people roughly did these ferries serve at that time?
It was probably a pretty small portion of the population. For example, when you look at some of the communities in the area, there really weren't too many people living there, so not too many people would have utilized such a river crossing.
When did the state of North Carolina begin to take over the ferry system?
Well, if you look at the extreme eastern portion of North Carolina and the coastal ferries that operated, those started as private operations as well, but they weren't really taken over by the state of North Carolina until the earliest was 1945, the Croatan Sound Ferry from Mann's Harbor to Mania.
What kind of toll system or price system did they employ early on?
Well, for some of these, they were still operating as a no-toll ferry. Some that did operate as a toll, when the state took them over, it was a pretty minimal charge.
How has the state grown upgrading the ferry system since then and going into the 21st century?
Well, they've added several new runs over the years. The vessels have obviously gotten a lot larger to accommodate seasonal traffic for tourism, and they estimate maybe 150,000 vehicles and 2 million passengers per year were the second largest ferry system in the United States.
That is, of course, in large part to the popularity of tourism here in the state.
Yeah, definitely. Tied to the local beaches and people's desire to get to the remote barrier islands.
Now, as more people either visit to the state or move permanently, is there a move somewhere in the future for the ferry system to increase hours as it becomes available?
The articles that I've seen and kind of been pointing more towards different types of vessels to be used and maybe even focusing more on passenger vessels, at least for some of those Outer Banks ferries. So that will be interesting to see how those develop as the islands change themselves. We'll have to adapt to how we get to them.
If you want to know more about the history of early ferry crossings in North Carolina, Mr. Orlando Lee will be giving a presentation on Wednesday afternoon at the museum in Beaufort. And Ben, is this presentation sort of like a more expanded version of what we've talked about today?
It sure is, and I've got a slideshow of images to go through and go over some of these different ferry operations that were going on throughout eastern North Carolina.
Ben Wunderlich is the Associate Museum Curator at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Beaufort. Thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
You're very welcome.
Summer is coming, with the traditional start of the season, Memorial Day, about a month away. The summer for many means travel to popular eastern North Carolina beaches in and around cities like Wilmington, Moorhead City, and Killdevil Hills. A new book highlights the sights of coastal beaches less traveled. George Olson has this.
A Wikipedia entry on coffee table books mentions the format is intended essentially for display over perusal, to some extent a book you'd always see but never read. But the format has a higher stature than one might think. A former director of the Sierra Club, David Brower, again according to Wikipedia, is sometimes credited with the modern coffee table book as he sought a format with, quote, a page size big enough to carry a given image's dynamic. The late Mr. Brower would be impressed with a new coffee table book, North Carolina's Barrier Islands, Wonders of Sand, Sea, and Sky.
There's lots of books about the coast of North Carolina. A lot of them are from a human perspective. You know, they're about human history, or they're about lighthouses or fishing boats. And this book is from nature's perspective. I'm using the sciences of ecology and geology to help me tell stories about each of these islands, about what makes each island unique and special.
That's author and photographer David Blevins of Cary describing his goal for the book, which showcases over 150 high-quality images from the state's coastal region. And unlike my own personal belief on how photography collections usually come about, blindly snap a lot of pictures and then hope something coherent ensues, Blevins says in this case, his process was exactly the opposite.
There's a whole process to creating a book like this. I start with the premise of the book, and I go out to create the images the book needs. But at the same time, this is a coffee table book, and you know, you've got to have really spectacular quality images. And if I were just making high quality images, that would be a lot easier. But I'm trying to create images that connect with the stories about each of these islands.
For all the planning involved in putting together North Carolina's barrier islands, Blevins will tell you happenstance was involved as well. He points out an underwater shot he got of a blue crab, a shot he had hoped to get, a shot he never thought would happen.
I was hiking over to Shackelford Banks. The tide was out, and the water was a little too shallow to get the boat up to shore. So I jumped out of the boat, and I was wading ashore in about thigh-deep water when something scurried along right in front of my feet, and I caught a quick glimpse of it and realized it was a blue crab. And I wanted to get a picture of a blue crab in the book, but it was one of those things that I knew it would just be luck if it happened. And so when I saw it scurry past me, I got out my point-and-shoot camera, and I moved a little closer to it. And I didn't really expect it to work because blue crabs are really fast, and I figured it would just take off and not let me get very close. But it didn't. It stood its ground. And as I was setting up the shot, I realized why it was standing its ground, and that is the female blue crab can't mate unless she's just molted. So right after mating, the male sticks around to defend her while her shell hardens. And that's what was happening, is he was standing his ground right over his mate, protecting her from me. And that allowed me to get the shot. And that's the sort of special wildlife moment that, you know, you can't plan that sort of thing.
Blevins says about half of the shots in the book were purely intentional, which my rudimentary math skills indicate that about half were not. Another instance of the latter would be a photograph of a Cooper's hawk displaying behavior out of character. Blevins notes his experience with Cooper's hawks is they are more likely to feed on small birds, but in this instance he came upon one who had taken a marsh rabbit. It happens just as Blevins came down a trail at the Pine Island Audubon Sanctuary. His appearance startled the hawk, which flew off, but if the event was unplanned, Blevins used techniques he'd practiced to get the hawk to return so he could get a now-planned shot.
They're really spectacular birds. And so I used another technique that I occasionally use, which is I set the camera up about 5 feet from the rabbit and just put it on a program, taking a photograph every 5 or 10 seconds. I can't remember exactly. And set it on autofocus and just walked away. And the bird is concerned about me, not the camera. So, and since I knew it was going to be coming back to that rabbit, that's a known location. And I can just set the camera up, have it shoot a picture every 5 to 10 seconds. And so I walked away 50 feet and just watched through binoculars as the bird came back and fed on his rabbit. And the camera just shot, you know, 30 or so pictures of him feeding on the rabbit and then flying off.
While he wanted the book to be from nature's perspective, at the same time he knew he couldn't take photos of the state's barrier islands without touching on the influence that human development has had on natural areas. The most striking example of that is a shot of Highway 12 on Hatteras Island shortly after Hurricane Sandy passed well offshore in October 2012. The ocean overwashes the highway, destroying dunes, buckling pavement in a manner that seems to match a roiling ocean, leaving an imprint which Blevins would tell you would never be noticed if not for man's footprint.
If you're at a completely natural beach right after a storm, it looks like the beach before the storm. Like a storm doesn't really make a beach look any different. It's still got surf and sand, and the dunes might be flatter, but it still looks like a beach. So to really show the impact of a storm, I needed some human element there to contrast with the natural forces.
Perhaps the book's most powerful shots appear toward its end, and somewhat appropriately, one photo being the photo he wanted to take, the other the photo he happened upon. The first photo was a 10-minute exposure of a sea turtle laying eggs on Cape Fear, the Milky Way in the background, its stars the only light illuminating the beach on the night of the new moon.
That was the image that I intended to make, but I agree with you that the image on the following page, after she finished laying her eggs and she was successful, she turned around and started heading back to the ocean. And while she was walking, of course, she's moving too fast for me to shoot an image. She would just be a blur. But she's so tired. As soon as she got to the surf and the water touched her, she stopped and rested. And while she rested, she sat still enough for me to get another shot. And this time I set up the composition with her tracks leading you off into the distance, sort of mirroring the Milky Way in the sky. And that shot just happened. Like, when I saw that, I knew that was an image, but I had never conceived of an image like that previously. A lot of my images are, I think about them in advance and I plan them, but that just happened. And that's just a spectacular, special moment.
David Blevins' collection of that and other moments is entitled North Carolina Barrier Islands, Wonders of Sand, Sea, and Sky, and is published by UNC Press. I'm George Olson.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.